Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast which takes ideas seriously. I'm Alistair Benn, and I'm joined by Paul Lay, Senior Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and Ian Martin, Director of EI. Today, we discuss the events of the past year. What, if any, is the deep meaning of 2023? At times in the past year, the promise of genuine renewal in the fortunes of the Western Alliance has appeared to be taking shape, but there have been almighty setbacks. In attempting to give a full picture of 2023, we will discuss the rise of artificial intelligence, increasing turmoil in the Middle East, difficulties for Ukraine and its allies in the country's fight against Russian aggression, and a decidedly mixed global economic picture. I turn to you first, Ian. With the launch of ChatGPT-4 in March by the tech company OpenAI, followed by a plethora of other large language models with catchy names like Bloom, Palm, Llama, Lambda, and intriguingly, Claude, the promise of a computerized intelligence completing tasks once thought to be the preserve of human beings appears to have been realized. This story also has an intriguing coda with the dethroning and subsequent reinstatement of Sam Altman, the Wunderkind of Silicon Valley at the company. But how much of the AI revolution is hype, and how much genuinely transformative? And a secondary question, how worried should we be?
Well, on the question of hype, yes, obviously a lot of hype is involved. That's how Silicon Valley works. That's how valuations work in that world, is that you're relentlessly upbeat and you create this sense of momentum and of the doubling of revenue and doubling of the size of the company and valuation in rapid pace, every 6 months, every year. So there's always the temptation or the requirement to talk up what's new. That's part of the great story of Silicon Valley. But it did feel to me, and some of it was towards the end of last year, but as you said earlier this year in the spring, those breakthroughs in AI. I think, we've talked about this on this podcast on EI Talks before. I do think it is very significant, and I do think we got a glimpse this year of how that world we're going to be living in sooner than we think, what it looks like. And of course, the row at OpenAI was about the board essentially feeling that it hadn't been told the entire truth by Sam Altman, who's one of the founders of OpenAI, about a development, a great breakthrough, which could be, it's a sort of X moment in the development of AI, the moment at which the machine can go beyond just processing of the kind that you described, Alistair, and starts to do something close to thinking. And I think I think it was very, very revealing what happened to the board that tried to fire Altman and replace him. It was fired itself. So it was a really troubling example of one of the central components of capitalism there failing, which is that board oversight is, I know from the financial crisis and having written about it, how boards operate and whether they're respected and whether they're an integral part of the system or not, they're absolutely vital. And when that swept aside and Altman got his job back and the board or some members of the board were disappeared, that was a warning sign to me. And I think that means the next couple of years or next year certainly will be dominated by an even more intense debate about how you regulate those companies.
So it was a victory for the visionary elements in the company.
Well, we know that the AI movement is divided, and that divide was there on the OpenAI board. It's divided between those who think that it has incredible possibilities and must be utilized as fast as possible commercially. Now, of course, commerce is a great thing and profit is a great thing, but their critics would say they're too commercial in their approach. Then there are the other faction in the AI world, who believe that it can do important, positive things, but it also carries a lot of dangers and risks, and that you shouldn't overemphasize the commercial aspects of it. So you saw that play out in the OpenAI spat, and Altman and Microsoft, who are big investors in OpenAI, that commercial approach won.
Paul, where do you think we're going next? What's the next step?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the thing that we do know about AI is it will bring about change, potentially enormous change, but we just don't know what. And I think that that split that Ian's been talking about is indicative of that, that the visionaries did win that battle. The idealist, it's a very Californian battle, I suppose. I think back to Frank Gavin's piece about the making of California that we published relatively recently, in that you have that constant struggle between hyper-capitalism, you know, this is the home to the world's richest companies, but you also have it of this birthplace of what is now the wake of hippiedom, this idealism. What I think makes it different from the tensions that we've seen in the past at, say, companies like Apple and Google, is that the technology they were using was relatively known, and they knew what they were aiming for with the with algorithms and the mastery of these forms that were actually known. But I think we're dealing with known unknowns and even unknown unknowns here. And so the visionaries have that upper hand. The lesson is that once they get a grip on things, the money, the capital wins out. But I think we're a long, long way from that because we just don't know what's happening. It's interesting. I was quite taken by comments by Craig Martell, who's the head of AI at the United States Defense Department, who obviously has embraced AI. I mean, my goodness, the American military network will have put an enormous amount of money in this, and we'll have this alliance between the Californian and Texan high-tech companies and everything. But he was talking about that it can't be used for really, really serious things, and that includes, obviously, the United States military with its devastating potential, unless what he calls it has a 5.9 level of accuracy. That means 99.999% level. So there's a lot of uncertainty about this. There's this tension between it crushing data in a predictive kind of sense and whether that can create something akin to human reason. And I think there's a lot of doubt over that. And I'd be sceptical over that, although it's not out of this world that could be realised at some point, but I think we're a long way away from that. But I think that Martell's comments almost remind us of the things that matter. At first, I think that AI will probably increase productivity in things that are fairly lower order, like it'll take over people in terms of, you know, the person you chat with on the telephone when you're trying to pay your bill or something, you know, that is already happening, all that kind of stuff, that lower order stuff, which is neither life nor death, and that will just take over. But I think there are other aspects where we'll be much more wary of the power of AI. But as I say, the question is, we simply can't get a grasp of what AI will do at this point and how successful it will be.
But you do sometimes wonder, or I sometimes wonder, about the intelligence stroke common sense of some of those involved. There was a very good piece towards the end of this year in the Financial Times, a long read about an explainer on AI. And quoted in it was one of the leading exponents who said, such a revealing quote, he said, "It's tremendously exciting, AI. It's tremendously exciting. We're going to have these machines, these robots working for us. They're going to be more intelligent than we are. But it's okay. It's okay because we're going to be in control." Now, that is such a, with respect to some of my favorite people are from California, but it's one such a Californian thing to say. And so divorced from the realities of how history works and how human development works. If the machines are studying human history and they're processing every bit of literature, every bit of nonfiction, everything about psychology, then of course they're learning that deception is one of the main elements of the human story. So if they're cleverer than us, relatively soon, it should be obvious to a Silicon Valley executive that there is plenty of scope there for them to work out how they can deceive us and convince us for a while that they are still under our control while doing, well, who knows what. The other thing that I wanted to mention from this year is that, I mean, Elon Musk has been in the news a lot for the disaster at Twitter that's unfolding. But actually his other thing, or one of his other projects, Tesla, really interesting little video that emerged of the robot program that they have at Tesla. And actually quite a creepy little video of how human-like this robot now is and the sort of the movement that it has. They're developing very, very fast. Now, if you put together that robotics, you put together that with AI and what we've just described, and then you add in quantum computing, which we won't get into trying to explain what it is. I'm not sure I've ever fully understood it, but just think of it in terms of ever faster computers and computing power. You add all of that together, the thing that seems obvious there, and you can tell where this is going to kick in first, is the scope there in terms of warfare and military matters. If you add all that together and add in weaponry, then you're not that far away on a battlefield like the Ukraine battlefield or one of the other wars raging in the world where that kind of technology is going to start to be used to prosecute war. I think that's much closer than people think, and may change the balance. We're going to come on to talk about Ukraine, may change the balance of power, dispensation of forces in a battle between a big state like Russia and a small but technologically advanced state potentially like Ukraine.
It's interesting that for all America's manifest flaws, we are drawn back to talking about this debate in a way that's framed by the dynamics of American capitalism, its intrinsic vitality, the way in which international talent is drawn to the orbit of America. And that's the story of the last 40 years. Look at the great, look at the things that define modern life. They all come mostly from the genius of people who may not be from America, but have gone to America and gone through its university systems and have experienced a particular aspect of American life. For all its flaws, America retains its intrinsic dynamism.
No, absolutely. And I think there's another thing that's, I think, is related to AI that we don't talk about enough in terms of the way it changes human consciousness and stuff, and that's pornography, which is another, in terms of the pornography industry, is one of California's, you know, great exports. And I think when you're talking, Ian, about that West World scenario of these ever more lifelike robots, whatever we wish to call them, there is this kind of pornographic element there to that stuff as well, which I think, you know, I'll just raise that point, but I think you can only imagine, you know, the mind boggles there. But I think also in terms of behaviour that perhaps is unacceptable between humans, then suddenly becomes not acceptable, but becomes possible. And you open up a whole kind of moral stuff that actually reminds me rather of the kind of slave revolt we've talked. We've had a lot of stuff about classics. We deal a lot with classics here. And that shift from what we call the pagan world into a Christian world that we recognise, at least in the West and certainly in the United States, and whether we're reverting back away from that Christendom back to a kind of paganism that this may enable, and this whole moral framework that potentially collapses has the potential to change human nature.
Let's not forget that many of these tech gurus who are interested in transforming life, somewhat hubristically, you might argue, are often drenched in the world of sci-fi. They've grown up reading endless sci-fi produced by American writers and beyond. And I think that's really interesting, is a lot of the dynamism that you see is people who actually have learnt a lot from quite traditional media, but it's allowed them to be extremely visionary, but perhaps not mediated by other moral concerns and other spheres of human endeavour. It's all very inward-looking.
Yes, it's all rather idealistic, and I think this is where, you know, if there's one person you wish was still around, it's J.G. Ballard. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned America there, and the paradox, I'm sure we're going to reference American politics because it getting crazier. There's an election next year. It's been very interesting this year. But the paradox at the heart of it is that America is still, it's still the essential technological, military power, still in certain senses, the great cultural driver of the West and the non-Western and the non-Western world. And in certain respects, an enormously, still an enormously successful country. Okay, politics is very, very dysfunctional. Walter Russell Mead referring to what had happened at Harvard and Penn and MIT in terms of the congressional hearings on anti-Semitism recently, and those answers, which were, let's put it politely, inadequate and were rightly condemned. As he put it, this really is the disintegration of American corporate and institutional leadership. It's spread from the presidency through to other institutions. That's true, I think, but simultaneously, America is still growing. It doesn't have an energy crisis like Europe has, so it can still pile cheap energy into its companies, giving them a great advantage. So it has this economic dynamism. It has the tech revolution. It's at the forefront of AI, but then there's politics as well. And it's still growing relatively healthily, unlike Western Europe.
Yeah, and I think being more optimistic about AI and the potential of AI, you know, there are products and services that AI will produce that are as yet unimagined, and they're likely to be positive. You know, there are claims when you hear, we started talking about hyperbole. You know, there's a great deal of that. You'd think it was, you know, the invention of fire or electricity. But something like electricity, you know, 19th century offered new services. It offered new means of production. So in terms of that, I'd be quite positive about it. It's the interface between humans and advanced artificial intelligence where I think all the concern is.
Let's turn now to geopolitics. On Europe's eastern flank, Ukraine's counteroffensive against the occupying Russian force has largely failed in its stated objectives. In response, Western media has taken on an extremely pessimistic tone in its coverage of the conflict. Russia, it is suggested, is no longer a dysfunctional paper tiger, mired in incompetence and infighting, and operating in pursuit of poorly defined goals. It's a giant, awakening from slumber. Its economy is on war footing, and it has a legendary capacity for endurance. By contrast, Ukraine is increasingly portrayed as a kind of plucky freedom fighter who's run out of luck, time and resources, and must face up to the inevitable. But I wonder, is there a more hopeful story to tell, and can Ukraine spring any surprises in the new year?
Not sure if hopeful is the right word in the context. It has been a really, really difficult year, obviously, for Ukraine. Some advances and also some extraordinary successes, particularly in terms of the strikes made in Crimea and the way in which they've restricted the operations of the Russian fleet and created turmoil in the leadership. So there are successes. But there's no doubt that it's turning into what looks like a long conflict. But also consider the casualties on the Russian side. Very high casualties, of course, on the Ukrainian side as well. But the latest leaks from the US, or the reports from the US, suggest that Russia has lost, since the war began, we're coming up for the second anniversary in February, in excess of 300,000. Now, we consider when it went into the war, I think its combined arm, I think its army was about 360, 370,000, maybe slightly higher than that. So you consider the scale of what's been done in the last 2 years. And then they have, of course, had to backfill and recruit and draw from their prison population. But then they have retooled some of their manufacturing, and they have put themselves on a war footing. It's difficult to know, because on the one hand, there could be, if Ukraine can hold out, the technological side of things could end up benefiting Ukraine longer term. We just referred to it earlier about how fast warfare warfare is changing. My concern is if Ukraine is forced into some kind of humiliating peace, which strikes me as not really worth the paper it's not written on yet, because that would only be used by the Russians as an excuse for a pause to increase further production and then get ready for another go. It's not as though this conflict could be frozen completely. So there's that danger. But also, if he does, if he can claim some sort of victory, of course, it's not what the victory he originally wanted, you then have to start to take very seriously, and I think this is the big story of this year, very seriously, how quickly he would then potentially turn to other parts of Europe. Now, I'm not claiming for a second that he's going to invade Western Europe imminently, but I think we have to, in Western Europe, stop thinking of this in terms of a 10, 15 year, 20 year timeline in terms of how Europe thinks about its defence and potential to deter, but more in a 2, 3, 5 year time frame. Where is vulnerable? Obviously, what's happening on the Finnish border is in itself at the moment is interesting. And you look at Russian policy on the border there. The Baltics, as they keep reminding everyone else in Western Europe who listen, are very vulnerable, just a thin strip of land. There are other places that he or a future Russian leader could look to. The message seems to me it's right what people are saying, that Ukraine needs back to the hilt and we need to be doing more. But simultaneously, Western Europe, I think, has to become much better organized in terms of how it defends itself, and not to fight, but to deter. And deterrence, I think, is going to be a thing we hear a lot about in 2024.
Mm-hmm. To me, one of the lessons of the last 2 years, almost 2 years, in the Ukraine conflict is just much of the poverty of the analysis there, because, and I think this is compounded by social media, this idea that one minute, Ukraine is sweeping all before it and Russia's just, waiting for it just to knock on the door like the three little pigs, blow the house down. And of course it doesn't happen, because actually you can have a situation where Russia is still in the mire, quite literally, particularly through winter, and yet it can still be resilient for all kinds of reasons. And I think we haven't been subtle enough and nuanced enough. I'm not talking about Engelsberg ideas here. I'm talking about
the wider media.
And the truth is, I don't think anyone, neither Russia nor Ukraine, is doing particularly well.
Well, the distortions of producing a war economy, in any economy, are enormously wasteful. You think about, how draining the Second World War was for Britain. It was enormously costly, and it diverted all kinds of resources into.
And you do have to, I think, in Ukraine. I mean, I don't know whether this is happening in Russia, but I do think there's some concern in Ukraine. There's certainly some dissent among Ukrainian politicians, and even his top general, Valery Zhelezhny, who was talking about. He raised this word. This dreaded heretical word of stalemate, because the argument is, among some, that Zelensky's communication strategy has been rather too Panglossian, and it needs to be somewhat more nuanced and realistic. But I think Ian's right about the way in which the West needs to continue to back this, because it seems pretty obvious to me that Russia doesn't want a negotiation. I suspect that ultimately there will be some kind of negotiation, and that's why we need to back Ukraine as much as we've done in the past, however difficult that gets, so that when that negotiation probably inevitably, they're in the strongest possible position. But my fear is that Western backing, that the United States has been very strong, Germany certainly has been stepped up to the mark in some way. The UK has been shouting out loud in support of Ukraine. There have been real voices, of course, but I think what perhaps when we were talking about as long as it takes is in danger of becoming as long as we can. And that's the big worry for me there. But I think also the other thing that we've talked about Europe, Ian mentioned Europe, it needs to get its act together in terms of defence. But I think it's highlighted again the importance of NATO, which is imperiled in its current state by the potential re-election of a second term for Donald Trump. We know his opinions there. I don't think there's a certainty of withdrawal if Trump wins there. He's maybe more realistic in office than sometimes he is to his core audience. But I think we've also seen the strengthening of the G7. And I think that's been important, as well as the Five Eyes, because we've seen Japan becoming incorporated into this multipolar world, into the G7, in the dangers of a multipolar world. And of course, we have China and Taiwan, the issue there. But I think also the Five Eyes, the intelligence gathering, has shown its value as well. So I think it's a number of organisations that are absolutely crucial to what we would call the defence of the West.
Yeah, Japan, an increasingly central power, and I think also in the years ahead, South Korea is going to become ever more important. Firstly, in terms of its geopolitical positioning and where it sits in the region, but also its power as a manufacturer.
And serious tech as well.
Yeah, serious tech. And if you look at Poland is rearming, but look at the amount of material that the Poles have bought from South Korea. So, the other thing on Russia is that it's only 6 months ago, halfway through 2023, that there was the Wagner rebellion. Now, at that point, it was described at the time as a coup. Doesn't seem to have been a coup. It was a rebellion, more of a sort of internal internal fight for influence with the regime and power and contracts. But that was only 6 months ago, and it seemed as though for a few days, Putin was tottering. He wasn't. But regimes like that things can take a very sudden turn. I mean, democracies, of course, the weakness of being a democracy is that it's sometimes difficult to get things done, and that they can change direction, as America seems to be a bit on Ukraine at the moment, or there's some doubt about what America's attitude to Ukraine will be.
Many have to take account of the public sphere.
All of that. But those kind of autocracies can also be very brittle. And if they face some kind of internal fight, some sort of coup attempt, it can fall apart very, very quickly. It can fall apart in a week.
And sometimes be replaced by something worse.
That's the other possibility, yeah.
But just to reflect on the brittleness of autocratic regimes, in January, the CCP, under the leadership of Xi Jinping, about turned on its stark zero-COVID policies, which were, as we know, defined by stringent lockdowns enforced by, frankly, sinister deployment of new technologies. And I think this was the year where there's a broader public debate, broader public acceptance of the potentially calamitous fragilities in the Chinese system, which, you know, is an immensely powerful country, has enormous achievements, material achievements, but the distortions introduced by its totalitarian approach into its diplomatic relations and its society and are mirrored by the effects on societal stability. And I wonder if that's going to continue in the new year, and we might be surprised by continuing developments.
Quite possibly. It's been a year where there's been a lot of mainstream focus on China's debt dynamics. Also not talked enough about in the West is the demographic time bomb in China. I mean, Europe has its own problems in that regard. But you put all that together, plus the property crash, and you hear conflicting reports from people who travel in China or engaged in business with China. A variety of views come back. which is some very much on the sort of downward, you know, risks side of things. Others who say it's bouncing, it's coming back, and they're through the worst of their problems. I suppose we'll find out in the next sort of in the next couple of years. But it certainly does, I think, China's problems. You use the word totalitarianism there. We've talked about this a lot in on EI talks in various episodes that we've done. But it's that shift from authoritarianism to full-scale totalitarianism under the current Chinese leadership. That is, I think, what's helped to wake up the West and its allies to the idea that you're not dealing with what David Cameron, who is the UK's foreign secretary, but when he was prime minister, he used to talk of a golden era of UK Chinese relations. Well, that's all over. As Cameron himself now says, that world is gone, the world has changed completely. And there's a different conception of the Chinese leadership in the West, which was a niche view a couple of years ago, and now is the mainstream view.
Well, think of a parallel reality in which a democratic China facilitates a lab leak of a dangerous respiratory virus. Now, in this alternative reality, it happens, the tragedy happens. The Chinese government acknowledges what's happened immediately, tells people properly what's going on, then launches a proper investigation into what happens. Mm-hmm. There is huge public outcry, there is response, there is a furious debate. We all get to know what's happened much quicker than in our own reality. And what I'm really addressing is the ability of democracies to self-correct over time. I think it's been one of the great qualities of our own, of the countries we live in, that we might make mistakes, but we also have that ability to correct through trusted processes. The concern I have is that those processes were always lubricated by not having sort of lots of political correctness concerns about what you can and can't discuss, and a really kind of deeper historical awareness that meant people could understand the problem for what they were, mm. and provide creative solutions. COVID in this country, in the UK, where we're recording, we have an enormous public inquiry going on into COVID as we speak, and that started this year. Mm. And the inquiry has very little to say about history. There is no historical awareness involved. It's all rooted in its own quite a curiously constructed framework. In democracies, you need a combination of the furious debate, but you also need the debate to be grounded in a deeper awareness. And I think that's the paradox and the problem.
It's applied history, which is another great theme on Engelsberg ideas.
Going back to that golden era of UK-China relations, I think it's easier to see it now, and this bears some relation to the COVID business, is that it's much easier to deal with totalitarian countries, potential enemies, if you have wealth. And this is my real concern about the UK, Europe in general, the West, is that we are not generating enough wealth, we are not productive enough. And I think if you look back to 2010, that age of austerity, one of the reasons why we were so eager to do a deal with China and were happy to throw our morals out of with the bathwater was because we needed the cash. And you become ever more compromised in your dealings about security and everything else if you haven't got the cash. It really is important that the UK, along with other democracies, maintains its affluence, productivity, growth, GDP, because without that, we are very, very weak indeed. And we really are at the behest of other powers who, as we've seen with China, as we've seen with others, and the way in which London was opened up to the world, to some rather unsavoury characters as well, all through a desperate need for money that we weren't generating ourselves or we weren't clever enough about. And that's a big concern for me.
Ian, do you have a sense of some of the maybe better answers that people have come up with in the last year about both the UK and Europe's productivity crisis?
Not really. I mean, I have a sense this of it becoming of awareness increasing that it's a problem. And it is, as Paul said, it's a problem. It doesn't apply in every country in Western Europe. It doesn't apply, for example, in Poland, which is growing very fast. You can argue about how much that is catch-up, but actually that's a bit patronising, a bit of a patronising way to view it. And actually Poland is a phenomenal economic success story. And then, as I described earlier, is reinvesting some of that in defence and deterrence at speed. But in other countries around Europe, this year I just became more aware of that conversation surfacing and becoming mainstream. It'll be a big feature next year of European politics because there are the European elections. You'll then get a new dispensation in the EU. And behind the scenes, the main conversation in Europe is competitiveness, and Europe just feeling as though it's piled on tons and tons of regulation. I mean, the UK has its own regulation problems and has done the same, and has inherited a lot from its membership of the EU. So across the continent, there's this sense that something is clogged up. Too much regulation, insufficient dynamism. The contrast with America, which has most of the world's tech giants and is growing, and has affordable energy, as we mentioned earlier, is very stark. Mm. I think not much will happen in the next year or so because most of it will be taken up with the politics that results from the European elections, and then it takes time to form a new commission and all of that. It'll be really interesting to see, do those European elections and various other elections in Europe, does that suggest a move to the populist right, which is focused on migration and social issues, or is there also room and space for a slightly different argument about economics and about making Europe competitive or not? Because there needs to be, and there definitely needs to be.
And I think at least some of the anxiety about a potential return of Trump is in fact a kind of diverted anxiety from a sense that the US has become, since the pandemic, especially much more prosperous than Europe. And in a context where the US continues to outperform its closest allies, that inevitably creates distress in the relationship. However, you know, whatever the language is about how close we are, it is creates powerful distortions in the way we see both our own security and the way America sees both its own security and what it can afford to give us.
Well, on defence and security, Europe, in its widest possible sense, inside the EU and non-EU, needs a plan B on defence and security in case there is a major change in American politics in 2024. But on economics and competitiveness, Europe, UK included, needs a plan A and doesn't have a plan at the moment. But I think at least in 2023, there's now an awareness that it's a serious problem.
The story that has defined the last 3 months is Hamas's attack on the 7th of October into incursion into southern Israel, which signals the outbreak of war between Israel and the terrorist group which operates from the Gaza Strip. On 7th of October, more Jews were killed than on any single day since the Holocaust. And this was the bloodiest day in Israel's short history, with about 1,200 people killed, and many of them in horrific and degrading circumstances, while around 3,000 people were injured. The subsequent air campaign in Gaza and Israel's ground offensive has also led to thousands of deaths. The events of 7th of October have changed and will continue to change Israel forever, much like notable episodes in its history, like the Yom Kippur War and the war in 48. But what about the dynamics of the region as a whole? Paul, I'll turn to you.
Well, it was the most shocking event. I actually remember seeing first images of it, first reports of it, when I was in Paris. And I was thinking, God, my French is bad, because I could barely believe what I was seeing and hearing. But it was sadly also true. The kind of sexual violence, theatrical cruelty that we knew organisations like Daesh ISIS and now Hamas are capable of, but to see it actually within Israel on that grand scale really was the most shocking thing of all. What's going to happen on the wider scale? There's obviously the question of Iran, which is dangerous, potential, probably very close to being a nuclear state. Not a situation that Israel will or can be comfortable with. We've seen what Israel has done before when Iran has come close to nuclear weapons, so there is that instability there. But what has been the biggest shock to me has not been in terms of the global ramifications, implications of the attack of the 7th of October, but it's what it's told us about the West and populations within the West, and particularly those supporters of Islamism who have come out onto the streets of London and other capitals. Ian's talked about the recent tawdry events involving leaders of MIT and Penn State and Harvard. We've seen that anti-Semitism is rife, I must say, on a scale that I had no comprehension of. I've always regarded as anti-Semitism raising its head as the canary in the coal mine when people talk about extremism taking hold of a society. And it's very, very interesting that people who see Hitler and the rise of the Nazis in any political event are those who seem to be the apologists for this kind of thing. And I think we want to make a difference here between people who genuinely support a two-state solution or the cause of Palestine. I'm sure there are lots and lots of decent people. I know there are because I know people who've been on those marches. But there are far, far too many people there preaching hate, preaching anti-Semitism, indeed preaching terrorism in some parts.
Yeah, I mean, not in the UK. There's been a different response in countries such as France, yeah, which have taken a much tougher approach. And it does, I agree with absolutely all of that from Paul. It was, yes, one that is the singular key event of this last year, of 2023. And I fear the ripple effects of it are going to be felt for the next, you know, 5, 10 years longer. Very difficult to see how there is a peace deal that's doable out of this. There's no deal that Israel could do with Hamas. But at some point, of course, some sort of talks will have to be convened. At some point in the next year, you can imagine a scenario in which one of the Gulf states starts to hold talks, and if Israel feels sufficient comfort that it's done enough damage to Hamas, then perhaps talks start, and you have to then get back to a two-state solution. But that will also, I think, be influenced by the shape of Israeli politics, which is likely to change. Now, Netanyahu is still there, and he's been written off so many times, but it seems very difficult to see how he will survive this time. You look at the polling in Israel, there is a demand for change of some sort. So it seems possible some sort of break in the war, or there'll be a moment where Israel then transitions to a different government, whether it's led by Gantz or someone else. And in those circumstances, you can imagine the beginnings of some new dispensation, or an attempt at some new dispensation emerging. But we're an awful long way away from that at the moment, with Israel, of course, under huge pressure on the humanitarian front. But domestically, its population just determined that Hamas, completely understandably, after the horror of October the 7th, must be dealt with. Domestically, of course, and in Europe, there's the shadow again of potential terrorism, because you see, and we've had writing which touches on this on Engelsberg Ideas since those horrendous attacks, that it could be, one must fear, it's one of those kind of events which has a long tail in terms of radicalization online particularly, and that you feel its effects for years to come, I fear.
There are two parallel trends in recent Israeli history and in the history of what I guess what used to be called the Palestinian movement, that which I think are both missed by observers in the West, that Israel is not the plucky little country, resource poor, brave and daring that it was after the war, and that was the public perception of Israel, that they were, you know, plucky and small. They are now a technological giant, which export huge amounts of, a lot of countries in the region rely on Israel. They rely on Israel for energy. They rely on them for all kinds of things in their technological base. You know, the rapprochement between the nation of the two mosques, Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia, and Israel, which would effectively symbolically end the conflicts between the Arabs and Israel, is likely to continue at some point because that is in train. You know, there is no appetite in the Arab states at the moment. There might be appetite on the street, but at a state level, there is very little sympathy for Hamas.
And this is what you describe there. That's the extension of effect. That's the business of the Abraham Accords and what could flow from that is that it may well be that the attacks were designed to disrupt that and to, because the next big step is Saudi-Israeli economic and social cooperation, because with that technological advantage that the Israelis have and Saudi capital, there's a potential there for something very interesting economically to emerge in the region.
The tragedy would be, and has been, that Islamism has infested itself in the Palestinian movement to such an extent that they are now basically indistinguishable. And that is a tragedy for what used to be broadly termed the Palestinian movement. Mm-hmm. It's a tragedy for all the people in Gaza, for example, who don't support Hamas, which seems to be quite a large proportion of the population.
No, I think there has been a shift in the Arab world ever since the Arab street rose. And I think leaders have become very cautious. We've seen states all but destroyed, Syria, Libya. There are others who are extremely cautious, Egypt, for example, Jordan. These were all the countries that were the visceral enemies of Israel in previous wars. It is for think of Lebanon as well, which is all but a failed state. And so the axis of the Arab world has shifted very much to the Gulf. I think it's fair to say that, which of course then brings us back to where we started with Iran, because no one is a particular friend of Iran. Mm. We then have the wider geopolitics of what's Russia's relationship to Iran, what's China. You know, all that is incredibly complex potentially, but whatever it is a world that has changed completely.
That was 2023. I've been discussing the year gone by with my colleagues, Paul Lay and Ian Martin. And just before we wrap up for the year, let's now talk about the best in our cultural life, our books of the year. Paul, what were you especially impressed by?
Well, usually in a year when Peter Brown publishes a book, that's Peter Brown, the great historian of late antiquity, it's usually his book I choose. And indeed, he did have a book out this year called Journeys of the Mind, which was autobiographical work recounting his extraordinary academic career, and it's highly recommended, but it's not going to be my book of the year unusually this year. That goes to a book that actually reminded me a little bit of the works of Peter Brown, because it starts in late antiquity and goes up to the high Middle Ages. It's called Beatrice's Last Smile, or should that be Beatrice's Last Smile, which claims in its subtitle a new history of the Middle Ages. And I think it is in many ways. It's by a historian based in the United States, Mark Gregory Pegg. It's published by Oxford University Press. And it's an extraordinary arc of a book that begins and ends with two pretty brutal deaths. The first of Vibia Perpetua, who's an early Christian who's thrown to the lions, or rather is gored by a bull with a baying crowd in the Colosseum. And it ends with the death of Jean Le Pucelle, who, of course, is better known to us as Joan of Arc. And it really is this very, very engaging, epigrammatic work, beautifully written, strikingly told, that sees that pagan world transformed into a Christian one, but sees both as persecuting societies. But if you want a very clear, very well told, and actually, despite its the grim nature of much of its subject matter, entertaining read, and I do think it's one very scholarly, but also one that the general public could really enjoy, if that's quite the word, then it's Beatrice's Last Smile, A New History of the Middle Ages by Mark Gregory Pegg.
Ian, what did you enjoy?
So I would single out a book that Paul mentioned there, Journeys of the Mind by Peter Brown. Not my field of interest or let alone expertise, and a long book, so it took me a while, and takes me to all sorts of unexpected places. Fantastic social history also in the early pages, the early life in Ireland and the particular social strata that he came from, and then his experience of England, school and university, and then this endlessly fascinating intellectual voyage or journey that he goes on. So I would single that out. I would also flag up a book which produced by our colleagues at Stolpe Publishing, which is the Classics of Applied History, edited by our colleague Dr. Matthias Cesaris, and by John Bew and Andrew Earhart. It's really, really good collection, pulling together, doing precisely what it says on the tin, Classics of Applied History. Really interesting book. Two other books I want to mention. First, well, they're joint book of the year. I would pick Danny Finkelstein's book, which is Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, which is a family memoir of miraculous survival. It's, I declare an interest, Danny is a friend. Danny Finkelstein, a columnist on the Times in London. But it's such an extraordinary book, and it's a story that he has been waiting to tell for a long time, the right moment, because of this family story, both his mother and his father, who land up eventually after the war in North London from different strands, their families torn apart and won by the Soviet war machine and won by Hitler and the Holocaust. And it is, as it says, story of miraculous survival, a book I cannot recommend highly enough, and particularly in the context of what has happened since the horrors of October the 7th, needs to be read and reread. The other book that I would identify is by Ed Conway, Material World, which is a story of six substances which essentially make up the modern world. It began as a simple explainer, as he saw it, to try and explain how the world is made and how industrial processes work, and turned into something much more complicated or complex and interesting than that. It's beautifully written, and it makes you think a lot about the energy crisis, about subjects we talk about a lot on this podcast. It's eminently readable and what's absolutely thrilling read. So those would be my books of the year.
And if you want to read a wonderful review essay of Peter Brown's memoirs, Peter Zaris wrote an essay called The Many Worlds of Peter Brown, which was one of my personal highlights of the stuff we published this year. My book of the year was Emily Wilson's translation of the Iliad, which we podcasted about. A poem I know very well. It made me see it in a new light, and I think that's some achievement for any literary translator. Paul and Ian, thanks for coming on. We'll be back in 2024. Thank you for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.